On this edition of Celebrating Science, Rocky Kolb on the connection between inner space and outer space. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Quantum and the Cosmos, Rocky Kolb takes us from the quantum soup of elementary particles through the seeds of cosmic structure to the beautifully complex universe we observe today. He explores how the connection between inner space and outer space may hold the key to a deeper understanding of dark matter and dark energy. In addition to over 200 scientific papers, Professor Kolb is co-author of The Early Universe and author of the mainstream bestseller, Blind Watchers of the Sky. He is currently the director of the Particle Astrophysics Center at Fermilab and a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago.
This evening, I'd like to talk about the quantum and the cosmos. Now, when you first hear the quantum and the cosmos, you might think they're not connected. Quantum mechanics deals with the micro world, nature on the very smallest scales, and the cosmos is nature on the very largest scales. So what is the connection between the quantum world and the cosmos? So first, let me tell you a little bit about the work I do. Howard didn't mention it, but I am a cosmologist, and I'm proud of it. Cosmology is something that has been around for as long as there is recorded history. And the idea of cosmology is to try to understand basic, simple questions about the universe. What is the arrangement of the universe? What is the nature of space and time? The origin, the evolution of the universe? And what is the composition of the universe? And the bottom line of what we've learned over the past 20 or 25 years is that we can't understand the largest things in nature without first understanding the smallest things. This is the connection between the quantum and the cosmos. So universities have departments that neatly divide nature into a department of physics, chemistry, astronomy, biology. But nature itself is not so easily divisible. And what we've learned is that it's all connected. Now, this isn't a new idea. It was beautifully stated by the naturalist John Muir, who said, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. You really can't have a deep understanding of any one thing in the universe in isolation. It's all connected. And when we try to pick out the largest things in the universe, what we will find is that it's hitched to the smallest things in the universe. And that's the idea I would like to convey to you this evening. So I showed a slide of cosmology 1,000 years ago, how people envisioned the universe 1,000 years ago, and of course our cosmology, our view of the universe has changed since then. It's changed a lot even in the past 100 years. 100 years ago, we had different answers to the questions of the arrangement, nature of space and time, origin, evolution, and composition of the universe. Astronomers 100 years ago thought that the entire universe was roughly the size of our own Milky Way galaxy, about 30,000 light years in diameter and about 6,500 light years thick. It was also believed 100 years ago that the solar system resides in a location that is at or very near the center of the universe. Although, of course, astronomers knew that the Earth is not the center of the solar system, but it was still thought at that time that the solar system was the center of the universe. In terms of the nature of space and time, which will play a big role in modern cosmology, 100 years ago, it was thought that the nature of space and time is that space and time are absolute. They're just out there. They don't change. And in terms of the origin of the universe 100 years ago, we did not understand the physics of general relativity that Einstein developed that will allow us to address the question of the origin of the universe. So 100 years ago, the origin of the universe was not something you would go to an astronomy department to inquire about. Now we talk about the evolution of the universe, but 100 years ago, it was believed that the universe was stationary, that it always more or less had the properties that we observe now, that the universe was unchanging in time, it was stationary. And finally, an astronomer 100 years ago would say that the composition of the universe are stars in the hood, just stars in our local neighborhood. We live in a universe of stars. I'd like to demonstrate or talk to you about how all of these views of the universe has changed in the past 100 years and illustrate how our view of the quantum world is shaping our view of the universe. First, let me start with the arrangement of the universe. In 1918, the astronomer Harlow Shapley demonstrated that the solar system is not at the center of our Milky Way galaxy, but rather is in some distant suburb about 30,000 light years from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And we are not at rest in the Milky Way galaxy, but we're orbiting about the center of the Milky Way galaxy with a velocity of 450,000 miles per hour. Now, since I come from the US, I still have to talk in miles per hour because we're inching toward the metric system, but it's going to take a while to get there. So in 1918, we knew that we were not at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, but Harlow Shapley in particular thought that, again, there is only one galaxy in the universe, and that is the entire universe. In 1924, Edwin Hubble demonstrated that the nebula Andromeda is outside of the Milky Way galaxy and is some 2 million light years away. This was a remarkable discovery that greatly increased our view of the size of the universe. He also discovered that we are not at rest with respect to the Andromeda Galaxy, but the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way Galaxy were heading directly for a head-on collision. The Andromeda Galaxy is 2 million light years away, but we are falling into the Andromeda Galaxy with a velocity of 90,000 miles per hour. Now, so you can work out and discover that in about 1.5 billion years, we will collide with the Andromeda Galaxy. And it's no real reason to panic. We can try to calculate with a computer what happens when galaxies collide. And there's a movie here I'd like to show, which is a numerical simulation of a collision of two galaxies, sort of like the Milky Way and Andromeda. And you see that stars are flung out into space. The inner core of the galaxy remains behind. Many of the stars fall back, some percentage is lost, and you end up forming a larger galaxy. Now, I'll play this again. It's not in real time. Every second is equivalent to 100 million years. Playing it in real time is quite boring. So we don't watch this happening. We don't look through a telescope and watch galaxies actually in the colliding like this, but we see what we believe to be the debris of galaxy collisions. The upper panel is from the simulation that I just showed you, and this is an image from the Hubble Space Telescope of the MICE galaxies. It's called the MICE galaxies because astronomers a long time ago noticed the long mouse-like tails on these galaxies. So galaxy collisions are something that happen all the time. We don't have a movie that we can take in the sky of these things colliding because it takes billions of years, but we can see with telescopes different galaxies in the stages of collisions. Now, most of our galaxy is empty space. So stars and planets are not going to run into each other, but there will be a disruption of the shape of the galaxy when we do collide with the Andromeda Galaxy. Could be that the solar system will be flung far out into space and then come back down, eventually taking a billion years ago to settle down. But don't worry, don't run up your charge cards. It's not going to happen anytime soon, and it's not going to be a problem. Galaxies are not the largest things in the universe. Astronomers in the 1920s and 1930s realized that galaxies themselves seem to be clustered into larger groups, sometimes containing thousands and thousands of galaxies. These groups are known as clusters of galaxies. And in fact, our local group of galaxies, the Milky Way, Andromeda, and a few other pals, are on the outer edge of a cluster of galaxies known as the Virgo cluster, because it's off in the direction of the Virgo constellation, which is about 50 million light years away. There are other clusters of galaxies and even superclusters of galaxies. The Hydra supercluster of galaxies is 50 million light years away. The gravitational pull from these clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies pulls our defenseless local group through the universe with a velocity of 1,400,000 miles per hour, something that's not appreciated by many people. We are not at rest. We are moving with a velocity of 1,400,000 miles per hour. And tonight, when you leave the lecture, you can look straight up. This time of year, it's directly overhead around 9 o'clock at night. This is the direction we're going with the velocity of 1,400,000 miles per hour. I once explained to a gentleman standing outside of my car that I really wasn't going 90 miles an hour. A ticket was hard to explain to my insurance agent with a velocity of 1,400,000 miles per hour. In the past 10 or 15 or 20 years, we've learned that clusters of galaxies are not the largest things in the universe, and now we're just are able to comprehend the entire observable universe. What is the arrangement of matter in the entire observable universe? This is not an image taken from the telescope, but this is a computer simulation of what we believe the universe would look like if we looked at a box, say, 1.2 billion light years on the side. And we would see galaxies and clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies distributed throughout the universe in a rich web-like structure. This we call the cosmic wide web, even more important than the world wide web. So this is our modern view of the arrangement of the universe. You see, we've come vastly far from one galaxy to a universe containing billions and billions and billions of galaxies, on a universe that was only 30,000 light years in size to a universe that's billions of light years on the side. That's the observable universe. With this realization comes another question, and the question is, how? Why? Why is this the arrangement of the universe? Why is there this rich structure in the universe in the form of clusters of galaxies, stars, planet, people? Where did the structure come from? Our view of space and time was a classical view of space and time, and in physics we call this the Newtonian view of space and time. In Newton's remarkable, one of the most influential books ever written, The Principia, he wrote about space and time. And he said that absolute space in its own nature, without relation to anything external, remains always similar and immovable. He said similar words about time. In the Newtonian view of space and time are fixed. They're absolute. And what Newtonian physics studies is the motion of projectiles, particles through space and through time, forces, momentum acting over space and time. But space and time, in the Newtonian view of the universe, is fixed. Of course, this changed a little bit over 100 years ago with the work of Einstein and the idea that we have this normal view of space and time, that they're independent, but normal is a relative thing, according to Einstein. And he has a famous quote that is, if you are able to accept that space is curved and time is relative, wearing stripes with plaid seems relatively normal. This is his theory of fashion relativity. Not known for that. But what he's known is his other theories of relativity, which have to do with the nature of space and time. In 1905, while working in the Swiss Patent Office in Bern, Switzerland, Einstein was scribbling equations. He was a patent officer third class. The patent officer's first class must have really been something. And he looked at his equations and realized, came to the conclusion, because his equations told him that the way people have viewed space and time for all of history was wrong. And you have to view space and time as related quantities. There's not an independent space, there's not an independent time, there's only a space-time. You shouldn't talk of lengths and time intervals, you have to meld them together into a space-time interval. He didn't stop there. Later in 1915, when he was a professor at the University of Berlin, he looked at equations that he had developed, and his equations told him that the way we have viewed geometry since the time of Euclid was incomplete. That space can be, it's dynamical, it can change, it can respond to matter, it can be curved and warped and bent. And his theory of general relativity, his theory of gravity, is the door through which we view the universe today. It's the way we understand the nature of space and time. And it's the way we'll understand why there is structure in the universe. So the equations that he developed, his equations of general relativity, are the basis that we use to understand the origin of the universe. So his theory of relativity, his equations, are in some sense the laws of modern genesis. Now, most of you in the audience are familiar with Einstein's theory of relativity and know that, in fact, this isn't one equation. It's really a shorthand notation for 10 equations, like the Ten Commandments. Get it? Right? Now, my colleagues from Perimeter Institute will say, yes, there are 10 equations, but you only have to obey 6 of them, just like the Ten Commandments, right? 6 out of 10 is a pretty good day for a lot of people I know. An important thing about this equation is that it has a left-hand side and a right-hand side. Now, on the left-hand side is expressed everything to do with space and time, curvature of space, expansion of space, the melding of space and time. That's on the left-hand side of the equation. And on the right-hand side of the equation has to do with the distribution of matter and radiation in the universe, the fundamental laws of nature, the quantum world. So in Einstein's picture of gravity, matter and radiation tell space how to curve and time, space and time how to behave, space how to expand. And it is the geometry of space that tells matter how to move. It connects geometry and gravity. So when Einstein looked at this equation in 1915, he realized that he could do something about cosmology. He could, with this new tool he developed, study the universe as a whole. For the first time, he had the tools to study the universe. So when he looked at his equations, the thing, when I look at this equation, the thing that screams out to me and screams out to all of my colleagues in cosmology is that the universe is expanding. This equation yells, the universe is expanding. Einstein, who was remarkably adept at listening to what his equations told him in 1905 when he unified space and time, in 1915 when he unified geometry and gravity, somehow was deaf in 1917 to the fact that his equations were telling him that space should expand. Einstein was educated in the 19th century with the view of cosmology that the universe is stationary, that it doesn't expand. So he looked at his equations that took him 10 years to develop, and he said, my equations do not tell me that the universe is stationary. It tells me that the universe should be expanding. There must be something wrong with my equations. So he did something that was either incredibly clumsy or incredibly brilliant. He introduced another term known as a cosmological term. And in the last 100 years, we have improved on this by coming up with a completely original name for this. We now call it dark energy. That's the advance in 100 years. So he added this to the right-hand side of the equations and said, aha, now I can have a universe that's stationary. So here we had in 1917, the greatest physicist of the 20th century, perhaps the greatest, or certainly one of the greatest of all time, the world's greatest authority in physics, saying that the universe is stationary, and these are the equations that describe the stationary universe. But now, for the first time in history, cosmology is a science, because the proclamations, predictions, and theory of the world's greatest physicists can be upset and changed by observation, by observations by a basketball player. The basketball player was a member of the last decent athletic team we've had at the University of Chicago, the 1909 National Championship basketball team. And the person who upset this, the member of the 1909 National Championship basketball team, probably the last astronomer to be a starting member of a National Championship basketball team, was Edwin Hubble. So in addition to being a remarkable astronomer and physicist and scholar, he was also a remarkable athlete. It's remarkable that he was such a successful basketball player. He was 6 feet 2 inches tall, which we all know is the ideal height for a person. But for a basketball player, it's a little bit short. He once did something remarkable. He scored 15 points in a single game. The final score was 17-12. So he was quite remarkable. After graduating from the University of Chicago, Hubble went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. And he did not study astronomy in Oxford. He studied law, the only blemish on an otherwise exemplary record. But he returned to the U.S. after his years as a Rhodes Scholar, returned to the University of Chicago, received a PhD in astronomy, and in 1929, working at Mount Wilson Observatories outside of Pasadena, California, he discovered that space expands. So here, again, cosmology is a science. The ideas, the theories, the prejudice of the world's greatest physicists, the greatest authority on science, was overturned by observations. That is the hallmark of science. The discovery of the expansion of the universe convinced Einstein that his cosmological constant was not necessary and that he should look for solutions to his equations, the natural solutions that describe an expanding universe. The discovery of the expansion of the universe in 1929 was the first discovery in the 20th century, the first of two discoveries that are the foundation of the Big Bang theory. The second discovery was in 1965, made by these two gentlemen, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson. And what they discovered, quite by accident, is that no matter where they pointed their antenna, sensitive to microwave radiation, there was radiation coming into the antenna from all regions of the sky. What Penzias and Wilson had discovered quite accidentally was confirmation of a prediction of the Big Bang theory that there should be a background radiation in the universe, a cosmic background radiation, which today has a temperature of 3 degrees above absolute zero, or minus 454 degrees Fahrenheit. These two discoveries of the 20th century, the expansion of space by Hubble and the microwave background radiation by Penzias and Wilson, is evidence that the universe started from a hot, dense initial state and expanded to evolve to become the universe we observe today. Now, of course, in the US now, we have to say that this is only a theory. Just like evolution is only a theory. Now, as a theoretical physicist, I get quite upset when people say only a theory. A theory is a wonderful thing. Well, the expansion of the universe, the microwave background radiation, the Big Bang theory tells us that the universe evolves, it changes. And I study the history of the universe. I'm a historian, and I would like to summarize the history of the universe in sort of a musical sense by talking about the universe as the evolution of the universe as a cosmic symphony, the harmony of the worlds, to use a phrase of Johannes Kepler's book. So early in the history of the universe expanded more rapidly, and as the universe expands and cools, the tempo of the expansion slows. So let me tell you about some exciting things that happened in the history of the universe. First of all, the earliest time that we talk about is the Planck time. That's 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the bang. Now, my friends who are string theorists tell me, well, I don't have any friends who are string theorists. But if I did, they would tell me that the tempo of this was very chaotic. It was like vibrating strings. That's what was in the universe. It was the pizzicato movement. And it lasted for about 10 to the minus 43 seconds. And then for some reason we don't understand, the universe went to a new movement in the symphony. Again, a rapid expansion of the universe, a very rapid tempo known as cosmic inflation. And we don't know exactly when this occurred, but most theories point to a time of about 10 to the minus 35 seconds. Now, how can we talk with any confidence about what occurred 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the bang? And the reason is it's a science. It makes predictions that we can go out and make measurements for. Predictions that the microwave background radiation should not have the same temperature everywhere. It predicts fluctuations in the microwave background temperature. These fluctuations have been seen in exactly the form that inflation predicts. It also predicts that there should be a background of gravitational waves in the universe that we have not yet detected. We are actively looking for them. It could be one of the great discoveries of the 21st century, discovering the background gravitational waves produced 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the bang. Inflation also predicts that just as there are fluctuations in the temperature of the universe, there should be fluctuations in the matter density of the universe, and we'll see how those are the seeds of structure that grow over the eons in the history of the universe to become the galaxies and clusters of galaxies that we see. Inflation ended, and then there was another movement in the cosmic symphony where the universe was dominated by radiation, roughly for the first 10,000 year history of the universe. And there's a relic of that era. There's a fossil that we can go out and study, and that's the abundance of the light elements. Because 3 minutes after the bang in the radiation-dominated era, it was hot enough to produce elements. And the elements that were produced were hydrogen, mostly hydrogen, different isotopes of hydrogen that can be calculated and compared with observations, helium, and to make it through the first day, the universe required a little bit of lithium. So the only things that were made were hydrogen, helium, and lithium. Then, after about 10,000 years, the universe became matter-dominated, and I'll show you some computer simulations of the growth of structure. And if the observations are correct, then sometime roughly the day before yesterday in cosmic time, the universe started another phase of inflation, but with a much more leisurely tempo than the primordial cosmic inflation of 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the bang. So primordial inflation, 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the bang, leaves an imprint, a fossil evidence on the universe. Temperature fluctuations that are measured by satellites, and seeds of structure that grow to become the galaxies that we see today. So when we look out at the large-scale structure of the universe, when we look out on the microwave background radiation, we can look back in time, 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the bang, and understand the universe 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the bang. During inflation, during primordial inflation, the universe was expanding so rapidly that quantum mechanics went nuts. And these fluctuations in the temperature and the density were caused by the action of the quantum world. So usually you think of quantum mechanics as happening only on microscopic scales, but the expansion of the universe took quantum mechanical fluctuations and stretched them to sizes of the entire observable universe. If you had eyes that were sensitive to microwave radiation, and you go out, this is a picture of Waterloo, you go out, Chicago. You go out and look at the sky with your eyes sensitive to microwave radiation, you would see that the brightness of the sky is not the same everywhere. This is a pattern of vacuum quantum fluctuations that were produced in the early universe. Quantum fluctuations visible on the sky. We can't see them with our eyes, but with satellites and sensitive detectors, we can see them. In addition to the temperature fluctuations, there were also fluctuations in the distribution of matter. So maybe 100 million years after the bang, there was not a lot of structure in the universe. You don't see galaxies and stars and clusters, but the distribution of matter is not exactly uniform. There are cosmic seeds of structure which were planted by the quantum aspect of inflation 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the bang. And over time, these structures grow due to gravity. A million years after the bang, you start to be able to discern structure in the universe. 5 million years after the bang, you start to see a universe that resembles the large-scale structure of the universe we see today. And finally today, this from the primordial seeds planted by the quantum world of inflation, you can develop the universe that we see today. So our galaxy formed not in isolation, but in a series of what we call mergers and acquisitions with other galaxies and other structures in the universe. So this, again, is a numerical simulation where each second is going to represent 300 million year history in cosmic time. We're going to end up in this little region of space producing something that, for all intents and purposes, looks like our Milky Way galaxy. And now, understanding the evolution of the universe, understanding the quantum seeds that were planted by inflation, we can see how galaxies might form. So over time, slowly structure forms. We don't yet have a discernible galaxy there. Now we have something that looks like a galaxy. We can zoom in, but there's nothing exactly in that box yet. That will be our galaxy, but now it's going to merge with another galaxy. And then after it merges, it's going to form a larger galaxy, and it's going to have acquisitions of smaller galaxies. It's going to cannibalize all the matter around it, eventually grow to become something that looks like our Milky Way galaxy. We think that this is an illustration, a representation of what happened over the 14 billion year history of the universe that led to the formation of our Milky Way galaxy. Now let me turn to the composition of the universe. Simple question to ask a cosmologist. What is the universe made of? Well, one way you might try to find out is try to use the Hubble Space Telescope for 3 weeks, looking at one small region of the sky. And this is an image that would result. This is known as the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, the deepest visible image of the sky that's ever been taken. Now, if you study this, you'll see find a few stars, but what you'll find is that almost every almost every object is a galaxy. You're welcome to count them after the lecture. There are over 10,000 galaxies there. And if you surveyed the entire sky in the same way, you would count over 50,000 million galaxies. There are more galaxies visible to the Hubble Space Telescope than there are stars in our galaxy. We live in a universe of galaxies. Galaxies make up the visible universe. I think they're some of the most beautiful objects in nature. This is a composite image taken by the Spitzer Space Telescope of a nearby galaxy, M81. Now, we take these images of galaxies not just because they make beautiful pictures, but because we can learn something about the galaxy. One of the things we can learn about the galaxy is the mass of the galaxy. And we can determine the mass of the galaxy in two ways. We can see how much mass there is in stars and gas in the galaxy by seeing how bright the galaxy is, how much radiation it's emitting. We can also determine the mass of the galaxy by measuring how rapidly it's rotating. It's the gravitational force of all the matter in the galaxy that's keeping the galaxy together as it is rotating. And we can compare the two numbers. This later technique was pioneered by Vera Rubin. And what she discovered is something that's very strange, that what is observed is not what is expected if all of the mass of the galaxy is in the form of stars. It's not just M81. When we look at M33, another galaxy, when we look at galaxies, we see there's much more mass in the galaxy than we can account for in the form of stars. This we describe as an accounting irregularity. And it's so embarrassing. It's not a small part. There is 50 times more stuff that's invisible than what we can see. Imagine if that was your checkbook, that you only see 2% of the money that goes in. When you look at a picture of a galaxy, there are missing pieces in our view of the galaxy. We don't know what the dark matter is. There's some matter that's not emitting radiation. And this is known as dark matter. So when you look at a galaxy, you're only seeing a tip of the iceberg. And what you don't see matters. We don't see much of the matter. And not only that, it doesn't seem to be normal matter, the stuff out of which we are made, neutrons, protons, electrons, nuclei, atoms. The dark matter is not made of the stuff that you can get on a pizza topping. It's dark. We don't know what it is. Now, we haven't seen dark matter. People who tell you they see dark matter are off their medication. But we can ask our computer to tell us what a galaxy would look like if we could see dark matter. And this is a simulation by Jaime Navarro, who is at the University of Victoria now. And the galaxy that we see is here, but it seems to be surrounded in a halo of dark matter. We don't really know anything about the properties of the dark matter. This is what our computer tells us the galaxy would look like if we could see dark matter, but somehow we want to know what the dark matter is. And there are various ideas for the nature of the dark matter. Some people think that, in fact, there's no dark matter, and it's a new type of gravitational force that's only fooling us into thinking there's dark matter. These people are very bright, but they're wrong. Could be that the reason the matter is dark is because it's in the form of planets. It's not in the form of normal stars that are shining. Or it could be in a type of star that's used to be known as dwarf stars. But now in the politically correct era, they're called mass challenge stars. Mass challenge stars are also light challenge stars. A star is a tremendous balancing act between the tremendous gravitational pressure wanting to collapse a star and the tremendous thermal pressure wanting to push it apart. The more massive a star is, in general, the larger its gravitational force pressure trying to collapse it, the more thermal pressure you have to push it apart, and the brighter the star will be. That's for most stars. So planets, mass-challenged stars, or black holes would not emit a lot of light, and perhaps that's the dark matter, or at least that was a theory. But recently there have been observations that rule out planets, mass-challenged stars, and black holes. And the best explanation now, though of course we don't know, is that the dark matter is a new type of particle, a new quanta, that is a relic of the Big Bang. So somehow, early in the history of the universe, a particle was produced that today makes up most of the mass of the universe, a new type of particle that we don't see. Now, how can we try to understand what types of particles are made in the Big Bang? The key is that earlier in the history of the universe, the temperature was higher. Today, the temperature is only 3 degrees. When the sun was born about 4.6 billion years ago last Tuesday, the universe had a temperature of 4 degrees. When quasars started shining, the light's been shining, coming to us, when the universe was only about 1 billion years old, the temperature is 16 degrees. About 3 million years after the bang, it was hot as hell. The melting point of brimstone, 3.3 million years after the bang. To a cosmologist, hell is in our past, not in our future. Atoms were born 380,000 years after the bang, but here we have a problem. Because earlier than 380,000 years after the bang, the universe was so hot and dense that it was opaque. So no matter how large a telescope we build, we cannot look out in space back in time earlier than 380,000 years after the bang, because the universe is not transparent. Electromagnetic radiation does not go through it. However, we can reproduce in the laboratory the conditions of the early universe, the high temperature and pressure that are predicted to exist early in the history of the universe, and try to understand the types of particles that were produced there. So it could be that if WIMPs, if weakly interacting massive particles, if the dark matter was produced in the Big Bang, we can make them in the laboratory if we recreate the conditions. And that's what we try to do, to collide particles together to make WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, that is the dark matter, in a laboratory. And the types of laboratories we use is a laboratory where I work, Fermilab, Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, outside of Chicago. In this accelerator, we recreate the conditions of the Big Bang. By creating the conditions of the universe at early times, the accelerator is also a time machine, and in some sense, that is the world's largest telescope. Now, the idea of using an accelerator to learn something about astronomy is not really a new idea. It was first done by Galileo. This is the accelerator he used. It was a gravity-powered accelerator. You remember the story. He went to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped 2 graduate students. And he noticed that they hit the ground at the same time. And from this gravity-powered accelerator, he learned something about the nature of forces, momentum, acceleration, gravity, that later allowed Newton to understand the solar system. We use a particle accelerator to make the primordial soup. So the product of Fermilab is primordial soup. And I can tell you a little bit about the primordial soup we make at Fermilab. Let's imagine we have 1 can of primordial soup. We'll never make an entire can. But in 1 can of primordial soup, we would have the conditions that were present in the universe 4 million millionth of a second AB, after the bang, when the temperature of the universe was 3,000 million million degrees. What is the soup like? It's condensed. In 1 can of primordial soup, if you have an entire can, you would have one, it's so condensed, you would have 100 times the mass of the Earth. 50 times the mass of the Earth in matter, 50 times the mass of the Earth in antimatter, and a little bit extra matter that we don't quite understand yet why there's this little extra mountain of matter. Because what happens as the soup cools, the matter and antimatter annihilate, producing the radiation that we see today. And if there would be exactly equal amounts of matter and antimatter, it would have all annihilated, and the only thing in the universe would be radiation. We wouldn't have matter out of which to build galaxies and stars and planets and people. What else about the soup? It was hot. In every serving of primordial soup is 10 billion years of the total energy output of the sun. And we know what the ingredients of the primordial soup, it's in every spoonful, you would have every type of elementary particle that is produced at accelerators. Quarks, gluons, electron-type particles, WZs, neutrons, protons, gravitons, croutons. We haven't discovered the Higgs boson yet, but we feel we're on the verge of discovering it. And what we're looking for every day at the laboratory is the secret ingredient to the primordial soup, the dark matter. If it was produced in the Big Bang, it should be able to be produced when we recreate the Big Bang in the laboratory. We can also look for the dark matter by looking for the relic WIMPs, the relic dark matter. And this is done several places throughout the world. One place is in, not very far from here. It's in a remote part of northern Minnesota. That's redundant, isn't it? Every part of northern Minnesota is remote. But anyway, in northern Minnesota, there's a mine, and underground in this mine, there's ultra-sensitive detectors, and physicists are looking for the effect of a WIMP passing through the Earth, just nudging very gently a single atomic nucleus in some ultra-pure material. So this is science. There's a theory that most of the mass of the universe is in the form of a new quanta, a new type of particle. The implications of that is that we should be able to look for it and find it. So in terms of the composition of the universe, it's very embarrassing that we can't account for most of the mass of the universe, but that's not the most embarrassing thing. The most embarrassing thing is that it seems to be the revenge of Einstein. Remember, in 1917, he proposed this cosmological term, a cosmological constant. In 1929, Hubble discovered the expansion of the universe, which did away with the reason Einstein originally introduced the cosmological constant, or dark energy. And in 1934, Einstein called the introduction of the cosmological constant my biggest blunder. He did not know that 64 years later, astronomers would find evidence for the cosmological term. Astronomers would find evidence for dark energy. So now you see that you should never admit you're wrong. Look, if Einstein had stuck to his original idea, he could have been famous. But instead, he said, "No, I'm wrong." So astronomers have evidence for dark energy in the universe, part of the dark side of the universe, by determining the expansion history of the universe. If there's dark matter, only dark matter, matter and dark matter in the universe, then the expansion of the universe will be such that as the universe ages, its expansion will be slower. However, if there is dark energy, cosmological constant in the universe, the expansion of the universe will be ever more rapid with time. By looking out in space, looking back in time, astronomers can determine how the universe expands, how it expands with time, and they discover that it appears that it's expanding ever more rapidly, as if there's dark energy, Einstein's cosmological constant. And you can think of this as an intrinsic weight or mass density, mass energy density to empty space. How can empty space have a mass and energy associated with it? And this, again, ties in the quantum world. In particular, it ties in the quantum vacuum. So what I would like, something I try to have my students do, and I'd like you to do this evening, is to imagine nothing. To close your eyes and think about nothing. My students are really good at this. Imagine a region of space where there's nothing. So you might do this by taking a hollow metal sphere, drilling a hole in it, hooking up a vacuum pump, and pumping out all of the molecules, all the matter from inside the sphere. You can also put the sphere, make it very cold, in principle to zero temperature, so there's no radiation inside the sphere, and what you would have is something we call a vacuum. Although you can remove all the material and radiation, what you can't remove from the vacuum is quantum uncertainty. The uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics tells us that at every point in space, it's possible for a particle and antiparticle to come out of the vacuum, exist for a brief instant of time before it annihilates and disappears back into the vacuum. So nothing is something. Even nothing, the vacuum, has this going on. You cannot remove this. Nothing is something. That's something I learned, actually, because one time I noticed that my wife hadn't spoken to me for 3 or 4 weeks. And I knew I didn't do anything, but I said, is anything bothering you? And she says, it's nothing. I knew right away from physics that nothing actually is something. You see how useful physics is? In addition to the quantum nature of the vacuum from quantum uncertainty, modern physics tells us that in the universe, everywhere in the quantum vacuum, there is a Higgs potential. And it is the Higgs potential which gives mass to quanta like quarks and electrons. And nothing has energy. The amount of energy in the Higgs potential in the vacuum is 246 billion electron volts. So you can imagine doing the following experiment with a Higgs meter, not in a voltmeter that you measure electric fields, but a Higgs meter that you measure the Higgs field. So what you want to do is take one of the leads and put it anywhere in the universe, at any point in space in the universe. Then take the other lead and put it somewhere that's not in the universe. And if you do that, you would measure a potential energy of 246 billion electron volts, a tremendous potential energy in the Higgs potential in the vacuum. Now, you might be alarmed that with this tremendous potential energy, you wouldn't be electrocuted. You'd be Higgs-acuted. However, every place in the universe is at the same potential, so we do not measure an effect. This contributes to the quantum vacuum and the energy of the vacuum, to dark energy, to Einstein's cosmological constant. We don't understand how all of these contributions come together to produce something that's observed. Now, what is nothing? The poet Walt Whitman said, "To me, every hour of the light and dark is a miracle. Every cubic inch of space is a miracle." I think that's a beautiful thought. People are always looking for miracles in nature. But there's a miracle in nature directly under your nose. In the cubic inch of space under your nose, there's cosmic radiation from the Big Bang. In the cubic inch of space under your nose, there are about 1,000 photons, quanta of the radiation that were present from the Big Bang. There's dark matter under your nose. Not only doesn't it interact, it doesn't even smell. You can't smell it. There's dark energy under your nose, virtual particles, and a Higgs potential in the cubic inch of space under your nose. Every cubic inch of space is a miracle. So we come to the embarrassing situation today in cosmology when we talk about the composition of the universe that 95% of the universe is dark matter and dark energy that we don't know what it is. We only know about 5% of the universe. The rest of the 5% of the universe, most of hydrogen and helium in the universe is not in the form of stars, it's free in space. There are stars, neutrinos, elementary particles. Neutrinos have as much contribution to the total mass density of the universe as stars. And finally, chemical elements other than hydrogen and helium, The stuff out of which we are made is only an insignificant part of the total mass density of the universe. I'd like to show this because it really annoys chemists. So this week at Perimeter Institute, a group of us came together and tried to understand this problem. What is the dark energy? What is the dark matter? What is 95% of the universe? And if you would have been there at the talks this week at Perimeter, you would have come away with the idea that physicists are desperate. But I think that's a great thing. I mean, people are really excited about desperate people, right? I know this, Canada has much too much culture and class to know about this, but in the US there's a television program called Desperate Housewives. I know you've never seen it. But I have some idea that we could make a program about physicists, desperate physicists. And these are the people who are desperately here this week seeking out the nature of dark matter and dark energy. There's Frank Wilczek, many of you heard him last night. My colleague from Chicago, Sean Caro, he's here. He's desperate looking for dark energy. Paul Steinhardt is desperate to understand dark matter. Neil Turok from Cambridge, he's just desperate. We will solve our desperation eventually by understanding dark matter and dark energy with the connection of the quantum and the cosmos. To understand the largest things in the universe, we have to understand the smallest. This was stated by the astronomer Carl Sagan, who said, to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Many of you have read his books. I'll bet none of you follow his cookbook. So, cosmology today is much different than it was 100 years ago. 100 years ago, space and time were absolute. Now we know that they are relative. 100 years ago, it was not understood that there is an origin and evolution to the universe. Now we know that the origin of the universe was a Big Bang 13.78 billion years ago, and the evolution of the universe is that the universe is expanding, cooling, possibly accelerating today. The arrangement of the universe has changed from stars in one single galaxy to billions and billions of galaxies in a cosmic-wide web. And the composition of the universe has changed from stars in our hood to dark matter and dark energy. And by understanding the nature of the quantum world and its effect on the origin and evolution of the universe, we can understand how to start with the universe that is very simple, just a formless, shapeless fog of elementary particles, and over time develop and evolve into the beautiful universe we see today. Reminds me of a quote from Origin of Species by Darwin, who said, there is a grandeur in this view. From so simple a beginning, he wasn't talking about the Big Bang, but that's how I read it, endless forms, galaxies, clusters of galaxies, most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. He didn't say it about cosmology, but he might well have. Tempering this wonderful picture of the universe is the dark side, that 95% of the universe is dark. We only see 5% of the stuff shining at us, 5% of the universe we know about. 95% of the universe is a mystery. Now, I think Einstein started this game 100 years ago, and he would appreciate the mystery in the universe. In cosmology, Einstein said, the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. To Einstein, it was the source of all true art and science. Einstein thought that those who can no longer pause to wonder are as good as dead, their eyes are closed. Cosmologists today are no stranger to the mysteries of the universe. 95% of the universe is a mystery. But I know somewhere these mysteries will be solved. Somewhere out there, there is a child with the genius and imagination to one day reach up and connect the inner space of the cosmos, the inner space of the quantum, with the outer space of the cosmos. to solve our cosmic questions about the nature of dark matter and dark energy, and more importantly, to ask and develop their very own cosmic questions. Thank you very much.
I understand that from the time of Big Bang, we are going forward, the universe is expanding. When we look in the space with our telescopes, the light takes billions of years to reach us, so we are looking in the past. We also know that we are looking, watching the red shifts, and so we know that universe is going away, the galaxies are going away from us, so we are expanding. Does it implicate that at this juncture, we are at the leading edge of cosmological today?
Okay. Thank you for the question. It's a very difficult concept to get across, either to students that I teach or graduate students that I teach. So I've given up trying to get it across in public lectures because I've just failed. The idea that you can, that the Big Bang is a creation of space, it's an explosion of space, it's not an explosion of galaxies into empty space. So you should think of the expansion of the universe as space emerging between galaxies, not that there's an empty void of space out there and galaxies are flying off into space. And to do this, you really have to understand curvature of space and expansion of space. It's much easier to see if you would go to graduate school for 6 years in Chicago. I'd be happy to explain it to you. Tonight, I just want you to think of the expansion of the universe as an creation of space, an expansion of space, not as an expansion of matter or galaxies into empty space. So one of the consequences of this is that the universe does not have an edge that galaxies are expanding into, and it does not have a center of the explosion. Understanding and visualizing an explosion without a center is something that's very difficult to do. It's counterintuitive, and good luck tonight. Thank you for the question.
On the second last slide with the evolution, it wrote that the galaxy of the universe is expanding, it's accelerating, but it's cooling. So what could be driving that? What is it, energy or?
So the expansion, the microwave, the temperature of the universe decreases as the universe expands. And there are a couple of ways to visualize this. One is expansion sort of, in your experience, naturally leads to cooling. If you take this can of compressed air that you use to clean your computer or keyboard and spray compressed air out of it, the can becomes cold. Expansion leads to cooling. Now, understanding how the expansion of the universe leads to a cooling of the temperature is more complicated. But at the bottom line, it turns out that the temperature decreases because of conservation, a generalization of conservation of energy when you take into account the effect of gravity. So the temperature of the universe decreases because of the effect of gravity on the radiation. And it's not exactly the same experiment, but it's the same physics that you can do in an experiment on Earth. If you take a laser of a certain frequency and you shoot it up, as it leaves the gravitational field of the Earth, the individual photons in that radiation will have smaller energy. It will be redshifted because it interacts with the gravitational field of the Earth as it goes out. This is an experiment that's been done. That's the type of interaction that leads to the cooling of the radiation as the universe expands. It's because of the interaction of gravity and the fact that the gravitational field in the universe is changing as the universe expands.
How do we know the exact value of the Higgs field of the universe if we're observing it from the inside?
Okay, thank you. How do we know the exact value of the Higgs field? It's because that's what Higgs told us. this is model dependent. It's in a simple model where there is only one Higgs field. If there is only one Higgs field, precision measurements that we make at accelerators can tell us the value of the Higgs potential, although it can't tell us the value of the mass of the Higgs. So if there is only one Higgs, then its value, its value in the vacuum today is 246 billion electron volts, and this we can deduce from precision measurements at accelerators. Now, the key part of this entire picture of a Higgs potential and the Higgs field giving mass to electrons, W, Zs, and quarks is that no one has yet discovered a Higgs particle. We expect to discover it. There's a possibility we'll discover it at Fermilab in the next year and a half. If we don't, we expect to discover it when a larger accelerator in Geneva, Switzerland starts operation in 2008, the accelerator known as the Large Hadron Collider, which was built with plenty enough energy to produce the Higgs particle. So we don't go out with a Higgs meter and measure the Higgs vacuum, the Higgs potential energy, but this is what's predicted in a theory that is one of the most remarkably successful theories in physics. Nobel Prizes have been given for it. That doesn't mean it's right. But it makes a prediction that there's a Higgs particle, and if we find the Higgs particle, it will be very conclusive evidence that this is the value of the Higgs potential. So, you know, it's nothing I would bet my life on, but I might bet my colleague's life.
My question is more from a philosophical point of view, and what you're talking about, the 95% that we don't know, and the fact that our own brains, people tell us that we only use about 2 to 5% of our own brains, that maybe it's not a matter of our state of consciousness and what we're subjected to in our own ability to perceive a lot of these things that makes, that creates a problem that you have in this 95% mystery. I just wonder if you could expound on that.
Well, it is a philosophical question, but I do have a doctorate in philosophy. So. Thank you for the question. What was it again? Let me restate the question sort of another way. You know, it's remarkable to me. I think one of the true mysteries about the universe is not necessarily just the 95% we don't understand, but that we can comprehend so much of it. On a little rock on around an average star in a typical place in a galaxy, a species evolved to look up and ask questions about the universe and understand it is remarkable to me. I think it's something, as a species, we should all be proud about and never forget. Now, does our brain have the capacity to eventually understand the dark matter and dark energy? Or will it forever be outside of human comprehension? If it's forever outside of human comprehension, I'll always have a job. But I don't think it is. I think we will eventually understand it. 100 years from now, if you had talked to people about Higgs potentials, quantum mechanics, general relativity, people could not comprehend that. We are evolving and getting smarter, not individually, but maybe as a collectively. So it's the thought and the hope that eventually we will understand it that keeps me going. In particular, it's the hope that one day I'll understand it that keeps us going.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.